Welcome to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Monday, January 16th, 2023. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I participate in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am on Twitter and Gab at realistreport. And you can find me on Telegram at t.me/TheRealistReport. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to and help edit The Barnes Review, a bi-monthly revisionist history magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all the details. All right, today I am joined once again by John Massaro, author of Will Vaccines Be the End of Us? All right, John Massaro, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm fine, John, and thank you for having me on again.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it. I hope you had a very Merry Christmas, and I hope your new year is off on a positive note.
For the most part, yes, thankfully.
Good. Yeah, good, good. Well, I heard you on the Sane Asylum with our good friend Giuseppe, which I believe was back on February 4th, so a couple weeks ago, and that was
January
great.
January 4th.
Oh, I'm sorry. What did I just say? February?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, January 4th, so a couple weeks ago. Sorry about that. That was a great conversation, as I knew it would be, and I'd encourage people to check that out. I found it on speakfreeradio.com. And I followed Giuseppe's program there. You guys focused on your excellent book, Will Vaccines Be the End of Us?, which is available at your website, endtheshots.com. And it is also available from the bookstore of American Free Press. And, of course, I encourage everybody to go out and purchase a copy of the book. It's really one of the best that I've read on the topic of vaccines. And I highly recommend it. I will have links over to where you can actually purchase a copy when I post this program. So I just wanted to mention that briefly. And also one other quick side story. Shortly after we recorded our last podcast, I was in a thrift store basically, and I came across a book that reminded me of you. It was called Get Well Naturally: Nature's Way to Heal, How to Maintain Optimum Health Through Nutrition, and How to Treat Disease Naturally. It's written by a woman named Linda Clark, who also wrote another book that sounds very interesting that I don't have a copy of it, but she wrote another book called Stay Younger Longer. And anyways, the book is excellent. I haven't quite completed it yet. It's pretty long. One point she makes, though, repeatedly throughout the book, and even quotes many, even traditional doctors, is that vaccines are way overhyped. They're often counterproductive. They have very negative side effects, which are never talked about. And basically that vaccines just do not work as commonly advertised by the makers of these poisons. The book was published in 1965, and I'm very skeptical that such a book would be published today, at least by a mainstream publisher. And I don't even think she could find any doctors today that would be outright skeptical or critical of vaccines, certainly not, you know, working in the profession. You know, you see a lot of dissident doctors
right.
that have come out with the COVID thing.
Yes.
But so anyways, I just wanted to bring that up as well. It's a really, really interesting book, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, just quickly, just to touch on vaccines, you know, after all my research, you know, in my spare time, I spent 30 years researching that book. And yet, it just comes back to the very simple observation of when I was a kid growing up in the early 1960s, everybody I knew, all the kids I knew, and I knew a lot because I grew up in a densely populated suburb of Long Island. So I knew a lot of kids, and all of us got at most five or six doses, and all of us are so much more – well, I don't know what's going on now, but I never saw anybody get really sick. Or if they got sick from chickenpox or measles, they were over it in a week. It was not a big deal. I mean, there's been such a sea change in this whole vaccine scene in the last two generations, and I think – With what's going on with this COVID jab now, a lot of people are really giving it a lot of serious thought, which is the only good consequence of what's going on now. Because what's going on now with this COVID jab is just an absolute global tragedy. And I think people are, a lot of people, even a lot of normies are starting to wake up to it. So, you know.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah, I tend to agree with you. And people need to understand that, look, even a generation ago, 1965, we had books being published about how you don't even need the mainstream medical establishment to maintain your health. You can get well naturally, as the title of this book explains. And, mm-hmm. This is a thick book. I mean, geez, I think it's like 400 pages. And yeah, I mean, it just goes through everything, how to treat any sort of illness or condition naturally, different therapeutic methods. So, I mean, this is something that people knew about even a generation ago. And, we've just been totally brainwashed with the, mm-hmm. The big pharma and just, mainstream medicine. You don't have to participate in it if you don't want to. That's certainly been my stance for a number of years now, and I'm sure it is yours and hopefully many of our listeners. So just wanted to mention that. Today we're actually going to be talking about a much different subject, although it is a topic that comes up in your book, Will Vaccines Be the End of Us? And that is your extensive travel history. I myself have always been a traveler, so this is a topic that I'm very interested in. I have not traveled nearly as much as you have, though. And to maybe get started, can you kind of just tell us how you became interested in traveling, where you've been to in the U.S., and how many foreign countries you've been to? I know you're basically one of the very few Americans to have ever visited North Korea and Iran, but I know you've mm-hmm. also been to many other exotic countries in Africa, in the Middle East, in Asia, in South America. I mean, you've been everywhere.
Well, I was lucky. I got, after I graduated college, and I had no idea why I went to college, I dropped out twice. And anyway, we'll make a long story short. In the 1980s, I eventually, maybe I should first say I'm 69 years old. I was born in 1953. And in the 1980s, I was driving an oil truck. That's what I fell into, home heating oil on Long Island, where I was born and raised. And for me, I was just very curious as a child. I always remember I was just very curious about the outside world. I wanted to see all the states. I remember when I was a little kid, there was a board game called Pirate and Traveler, which I played with my friends, and it showed a whole map of the world. You unfolded the board, and it showed a map of the world, and I was just mesmerized by all these foreign ports. I said, my God, I want to go there someday, and I never had any idea that I would. But anyway, when I became an oil truck driver, as I said, it was home heating, so it gets very slow in the summertime. And that gave me the opportunity right through the 1980s, almost every year, to go abroad on the average about 3 months every year through the 80s to see a certain part of the world. And I always traveled very, very cheaply. People have said to me, oh, you must have a lot of money. No, I didn't have a lot of money. I didn't make a whole lot of money as a blue-collar guy. But I just traveled very cheaply, mostly alone, I would say 80% of the time alone. Just taking public transport and such as it is, which is very, very cheap in most of the third world. So I kind of live my dream that way. And then I just to quickly touch up, I had I got married in 91. I had kids. My kids have problems, and anyway, just to push things up, I went through a divorce and my life pretty much changed, but things kind of reverted back to pretty much normal in 2002, and I started traveling again, but not as much as I did in the 80s when I had very few responsibilities. So all told, I've been to 97 countries, pretty much in every part of the world, and I have been to every state except Alaska. Now, in the 70s, I traveled. I've taken so many trips around the states. In the 70s, I made 4 hitchhiking trips from coast to coast. Which was a very, very educational experience. And it's kind of disappointing in a way to see that, hitchhiking is – nobody does it anymore. It was just a great way to get acquainted with my own country, meet people, meet real people. And, I wouldn't trade it for anything. So,
yeah.
So as far as North Korea goes, I would say, as I said, I've been to 97 countries. North Korea, I went there in 2013. I flew to from New York, with a few stops to Bangkok, Thailand. I had been to Thailand before, so I quickly went to Cambodia. I traveled to Cambodia, Vietnam, up through China, and you know, buses and trains pretty much. And then I had booked, you cannot go to North Korea as an independent traveler. So I had booked a one-week tour in August of 2013 with an outfit called Young Pioneer Tours. And just about all trips to North Korea begin and end in Beijing, in the Chinese capital of Beijing. So I would say North Korea, going there was like the only life-changing experience of them. My only life-changing travel experience. It was just so unique. And I just want to hit upon a lot of things. It's such an incredible thing to talk about. You know, I want to start off by saying this. Just to put things in their proper perspective, I would say, you know, first of all, it was from the Korean War on, up right up to 2010, it was Americans could not go to North Korea. Then in January of 2010, they changed their policy, and they did let American tourists in. I think other foreign tourists had been permitted to go there from roughly about 2000, I believe. But when I heard that Americans could go there, I said, I got to see this place. There was just something about it. It was just so, it was like, to me, it was like going to Mars or something like that. You know, it's the most sealed off, isolated country in the world. Anyway, from 2010 to 2017, it was legal for Americans to go there. I went there in 2013. Now, in the last five and a half years or so, we can't go there. So I was very happy to go there when the opportunity came up.
And you only did one trip to North Korea?
Oh yeah, just one.
Yeah, just one trip. Yeah, okay, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. That would be talk about it's one of the most, you know, isolated countries in the world. Wow, I couldn't even imagine. So tell us about the experience. I mean, how did you get there? You said you had to go to Beijing first, which is, if you look at a map, I mean, Beijing, I don't know exactly how far, you know, how many miles it is from, like, did you go to the, I'm assuming you went to the capital, Pyongyang?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a 90-minute flight.
No, yeah, okay, that's what I was going to ask. You actually, yeah, you flew there.
John, listen, you can jump in anytime you want with a question, but what I want to do is put everything in its proper perspective.
Sure.
First of all, let me say this. North Korea is a very, very stiff communist dictatorship. It's very repressive. But if you can put that aside, I want to read something from, this is one of my favorite books, and the older I get, the more I realize how prophetic George Orwell was when he wrote 1984. Now I have my paperback copy of 1984 from high school. It's falling apart. But I underline this, it's like 50 years old. I underline this, and this is so relevant. I just want to read a few lines here. War prisoners apart, the average citizen of Oceania never sets eyes on a citizen of either Eurasia or East Asia, and he is forbidden the knowledge of foreign languages. Now, here's the important part. If he were allowed contact with foreigners, he would discover that they were creatures similar to himself and that most of what he has been told about them is lies. The sealed world in which he lives would be broken, and the fear, hatred, and self-righteousness on which his morale depends might evaporate. And that is just so true. You know, I could tell you that from traveling around the world. Most people, you know, you talk to people, you know, especially like when they talk about the Middle East, these people are animals, they're fanatics. You know, it's such nonsense. You know, you just, 95% of the people you come across are pretty good people. And even if they're not good people, they're not dangerous, okay? So, and you know, we were talking a couple of days about the analogy, the parallel I wanted to make with Mississippi, you know, which I think this is very, very apropos. When I was 10 years old, in the summer of 1964, and like, as I said earlier, I was always very curious about the outside world, and nobody that I knew had ever been to the Deep South. And, in 1964, there was that incident where three civil rights workers, two of them were really left-wing Jews from New York that had gone down there to agitate all the blacks. They were murdered in Mississippi, and that made such an impression on me There was a very famous photograph of Cecil Price, who was a sheriff down in Neshoba County, Mississippi, and Lawrence Rainey being arraigned on, I guess, federal civil rights charges. And there was a picture of them. They were both sitting in the front row, I guess, of a courtroom with a lot of white, what I thought of as white trash in the background, just smiling, making a mockery of the whole thing. Here are these two sheriffs sitting in the front row. Rainey is stuffing his face full of chewing tobacco, and Price is just smirking. And I remember that photograph had such an impression on me that made me think, you know, look at these. It really made me think of Mississippi as a dark, dangerous, evil place, someplace I would never want to go. And there were so many stories, you know, having grown up in the North, you hear all these stories about the South, the Deep South. And also there was a picture of the three, before their bodies were found, there was an FBI poster showing Michael Schwerner, Andrew Goodman, who were, like I said, two Jewish agitators from New York, and a local black guy named James Cheney. And there was an FBI poster put out with a big heading, Missing. And that also made an impression on me. So, you know, I kind of juxtaposed those two pictures, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, these three really righteous, good-hearted people being murdered by this white trash down in Mississippi. And I can't – I know you were born sometime in the 1980s. I can't – and a lot of people listening to me now cannot really imagine what it was like in the 60s, the hatred, the media hatred that was heaped on the Deep South, especially Alabama and Mississippi. You know, and then you had the Hollywood movies. I don't know if you ever, I never saw these movies, but I knew about them. Easy Rider. You must have heard of that, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Easy Rider. I think – I never saw them. I think it ends with – and that was in Georgia, in the you know, the backwoods of Georgia. These two rebel motorcycle riders. I think it ends with one of them giving a finger to a pickup truck full of rednecks, and they just blow him away with a shotgun. And then there was Deliverance, which I think was about a couple of guys from Georgia, you know, middle class suburban type guys going canoeing like in remote Georgia, and then they're like kidnapped and sodomized by these hillbillies up in some remote area of Georgia, these toothless hillbillies. I mean, these images, these stories, and all this stuff made such an impression on me that I was, you know, I always thought of the Deep South that as a very dangerous, just exactly as the way I thought about North Korea. I said, you know, it's someplace you don't want to go. But, you know, being curious as I always was, I said, you know, I just got to go down and see what Mississippi is really like. And I still remember, this is the spring. It was April of 1978. My girlfriend and I, we just packed things up in my Aspen station wagon and just took a driving trip down to, to the Deep South. And I can still remember driving through Tennessee and getting on U.S. Route 45, getting closer and closer to the Mississippi border and thinking, I don't know, man, you know, people are going to see my New York license plates. They're going to hear my New York accent. I don't know what's going to happen. You know, I can't say I was really scared, but I thought I was going to be treated very, very coldly. Anyway, to make a long story short, we would drive. Finally, we get to Mississippi. You know, like it's like, again, it's like going into what most people imagine North Korea is like, a very dangerous, hostile place. And I still remember, it's just one of my great travel memories. We drove about 20 miles to a little town called Boonville. And we just stopped to have dinner. There was a little place. It was a little family restaurant called the Chicken Hut. And I remember walking in there thinking, okay, here it is. We're about to meet live Mississippians, you know. As soon as I open my mouth, they're going to hear my New York accent. I don't know what's going to happen. And we sat down, and we ordered something. And as soon as the waitress came over, she heard my accent. They were just so delighted that people – you know, how many people go to Mississippi? It's not like the biggest tourist destination. And she was just so tickled that, you know, here a couple from New York coming down and stopping in their little town. And She told other people that worked in the restaurant. They came over and chatted with us, and they were just the nicest people in the world. And I said, you know, and I remember when I went to sleep that night, I said, what have they done to my head? How could they have brainwashed me into thinking that, you know, these people are going to be hostile, you know, that they hate Northerners, all this business. It's probably been going on since the Civil War, you know, all this propaganda. But that was a great travel memory. And, you know, let me just say also, I've driven through the Deep South, you know, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, on county roads, state roads, everywhere. I have never, ever had a bad confrontation with people in the South. I mean, I've never, you know, they're just really good people, down to earth, good American people. And you know, let me just quickly say, I know I'm getting off on a tangent here, but do you know much about that story? I know you were born well after that happened.
Yeah.
Do you remember the two Jews
in the black that were murdered?
Yeah. Were you taught about that in school or anything?
Probably. It doesn't particularly stand out. I mean, I'm aware of the situation, you know, sort of vaguely, I guess, but no, I don't think it was something that was like really emphasized. I mean, I'm sure we learned about it, but it wasn't something that really stands out in my mind. But I think that overall narrative. I mean, this is the power of psychological warfare at its finest.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, that's what we're dealing with here, yeah. And this is something that's been going on for a very, very long time. And even to this current day, you see it, you know, the way the South is depicted, the way just white Americans in general are depicted as backwards and racist and hateful and, you know, intolerant and these sorts of things. So, yeah, I mean, this is the power of the Jewish media, and they're experts at doing this. They know exactly how to manipulate people.
I don't think these days the South doesn't get a bad rap like it did in the 60s. I mean, it was just unbelievable.
Yeah, I believe you.
I absorbed all this. I mean, it was, you know, you had Selma, you had Martin Luther King going into these towns in Birmingham and Selma and a few other places in Alabama just agitating. I mean, it was really wild in the 1960s. So,
looking back on it, I mean, of course, I wasn't alive, but it's basically just another sort of like color revolution that took place in the 60s, you know, with all these blacks rising up and terrorizing cities and the riots and the, you know, all the destruction and mayhem. And yeah, it's basically just another example of that.
Yeah, so anyway, you know, what you mentioned, psychological warfare, the same thing. So I wanted to – that makes a very good analogy with North Korea. I mean, whenever people think about North Korea, you have these images of, you know, these goose-stepping soldiers, these huge parades showing missiles and missile launches, this and that. You know, and the fact of the matter is that as far as I can determine, the ancient nation of Korea, which goes back thousands of years, they have never made war on another country, as far as I know. You know, you have to remember, Korea is a very small country. It just kind of hangs. It's a little peninsula on the very edge of Eastern Asia. And they are, you know, their main, ally, you would say, the country they're closest to, obviously, is China. That's the country they share the longest border with. But they also share a border with Russia, with, you know, they're way out there, you know, just south of Siberia. They sure have a very small border with Russia. And then you have Japan, a few hundred miles away. So they evolved. They were surrounded by huge, powerful countries, China, Russia, and Japan. So I think they must have evolved as kind of a peace-loving people. They couldn't afford to they could ill afford to be aggressive in any way. And as far as I know, they have, in their entire history going back thousands of years, they have never made war on another country. And I just want to bring something up very quickly in case I forget to mention. I do want to mention it was the Pueblo incident of 1968. I want to get to that. But anyway, so when you see – we've been so propagandized about, you know, North Korea being a terrible threat. By the way, did you read on the end of shots on my North Korea page? I reprinted a long article that was written in 2000 3, I think it was. Did you read that article by any chance?
I don't know if I read that one. I read quite a bit on the OrinocoTravel.com website about North Korea. Are you okay. referring to North Korea, a case study? Is that the article?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's in italics. It's about one third of the way down. It is a long article about, you know, let me just, I'm looking at the computer screen light now. Let me just punch up. Just to give you an idea of how, hold on one second. Let me just punch this up. Actually, you know, I'm going to read the heading of this article. It's so typical, but this was more pronounced than other ones. Okay, let me just see. Here it is. This is July, August 2003 edition of Patriot Report. That was a newsletter that came out of Panama, Oklahoma, that folded. Anyway, this is the huge headline. This is 2003 now, 20 years ago. North Korea continues saber rattling. America prepares for war. Then below that, in smaller letters, North Korean death wish baffles U.S. politicians and military experts. Irrational behavior of the communist dictatorship could lead to nuclear holocaust. Now, this is, you know, this kind of garbage, and it's still going on. I don't know how closely you follow the mainstream news. I just take a quick look at some of the websites of the networks, and the latest thing is the North Koreans just did another missile launch. I don't know if you caught that. But anyway, these kind of headlines have been going on I don't know how long now. And, you know, isn't it so strange that we've been hearing about this forever and nothing ever happens? They never attack another country. It's just continuous psychological warfare. So let me go back now to the Pueblo incident. Now, this took place in, I think most of the people listening to this are probably a good deal younger than me. This took place in January of 1968, and this was at the very peak of the Vietnam War. I was a freshman in high school at the time, and I still remember very clearly. I came out of band practice, and the band director, he had big news for us. An American ship, the Pueblo, had been attacked and captured by the North Koreans. I had heard, of course, about the country of Korea. I didn't know anything about them. I didn't know much about North Korea. Now, here we are. Now we have another communist enemy. And I'm thinking, like, oh, my God, you know, everything, what is happening in that part of the world? Anyway, what happened with that was that there was an American Navy ship, the Pueblo. They were a spy ship. And they were sailing about 15 miles off the coast of North Korea, about 3 miles outside of their claimed territorial waters. And of course, I want to get to what we did to that country in the Korean War, because that puts everything in its perspective. But they were suddenly harassed. A whole bunch of North Korean naval vessels came out. A few things transpired over a couple of hours. Then the North Koreans opened fire on them. Then they boarded the ship and they brought it back into back to Wonsan, North Korea. And the whole crew, I think there were about 80 American sailors, they were held prisoner for 11 months. It was huge news when it happened. Then it kind of faded away. And anyway, many years later, I read a book by Lloyd Bucher, who was the captain of that ship, which is a very interesting book. You know, I want to talk I want to talk about that a little bit down the line as I talk about the Korean War. But anyway, that was the first time I heard about North Korea. And it was just one of those places that was so completely isolated and hardly any news came out of it. The next news I heard was in 1976. There was an incident at the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, between North Korea and South Korea. It's the most fortified, heavily mined border in the world. And apparently, there were a couple of American soldiers that were pruning a tree in the DMZ, and a squad full of North Korean soldiers pulled up, and a big argument broke out, and the North Koreans beat them to death. I think they clubbed them to death. That was a big news. That was big news at the time. And I can still remember I was in college then, and I had a friend who was about to join the Navy. And we had become very anti-communist, and we saw a televised report of that, and we saw some of the North Koreans who had killed the American soldiers being greeted as heroes. And we had both seen that on TV, and we both had a big laugh about these fanatical communist Oriental savages, you know, what animals they were, you know. As I said before, just going back to what I read about Orwell, you know, the self-righteous, thinking you're so superior, looking down on these subhumans, communists. And anyway, that went by. And then in 1980, I was a big year of travel for me. I went to Japan, and I took the overnight ferry from just to have a look around South Korea. I took ferry from Japan to Busan, South Korea, and I went up to Seoul for a couple of days. I was only there for about 5 days. And when I was in Seoul, which is the capital of South Korea, I booked a half day trip up to the DMZ. I was so obsessed with North Korea. I mean, being as it was the most sealed off country in the world, I just had to see this, you know, just get a glimpse of across the DMZ, across the border to see what it was like. So I did like a half day trip. There were maybe seven or eight other people that had booked it. And it was really kind of eerie, you know, getting close to the border, you're having a feeling, get this feeling that you're really approaching a real danger zone, like real, you know, the most sealed off country in the world. I remember I could see a North Korean soldier in the distance looking at us through binoculars. And the person who led the tour was an American soldier stationed there. And he warned us, you know, he said, we're going to go right up to the border, the very border. He said, don't make any gestures. Do not, you know, don't make any movements that would provoke them in any way. So it was kind of a real buildup. And then we went.
Hey, John, you know what? Let me just ask you real quick. Don't you even have to sign a waiver saying, like, you're not going to, like, the Army can't be held liable if anything were to happen to you at the DMZ?
You know, I think I did. I vaguely remember. Now that you bring that up, I think I did.
Yeah, you read about that in one of the articles that I read about.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah. That just shows you like how potentially explosive this situation could be.
Yeah, I mean, so anyway, we get up there, and the actual border. Many people have seen pictures of this. There's a bunch of blue Quonset huts that are right at that straddle the exact border. And he said, we're going to go into one of these huts. He said, every now and then. The South and the North have talks, and we're going to go in there. And so he went in there, and then this is the American soldier talking now. And he said, the exact border is the microphone wire stretched across the table. So he said, if you want to go around to the other side, just to say you've been in North Korea, just quietly walk around. And I said, wow, this is awesome. You know, I can actually say I've been to North Korea. The exact line of demarcation is the microphone wire across the table. So anyway, long story short, I did that. It was a great experience. Nothing bad happened to us. As I said, I saw a North Korean soldier looking at us through binoculars, but that was the end of it. Nothing happened. So anyway, so that was 1980. And, you know, going down through the years, every once in a while you'd hear something about North Korea, this and that, you know, launching missiles, doing something, but it was just kind of, I just kind of forgot about it. Anyway, getting up to 2010 now, 30 years later, that's when I heard that Americans could go there for the first time. So I said, you know, I got to see this place. So I planned my trips maybe a year ahead of time. So in 2012, I said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go to North Korea. And as I said, in 2010, they allowed Americans in for the first time. So before a few months before my trip, now we're talking about early 2013, I said, let me do some research about this. I was just so fascinated just to be one of the very few Americans to go there on an ordinary tourist visa. So I looked for the first time. I don't remember where it was. You know, I'm surfing the net, and I came up with a link to Dean Rusk talking about North Korea in his memoirs. Now, let me ask you, does the name Dean Rusk ring a bell with you at all?
Yes. Wasn't he a former Secretary of State, if I'm not mistaken?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was the Secretary of State in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. So, you know, we're talking about when I was a kid now. So, you know, roughly from the age of when I was 7 to 15 years old, he was the Secretary of State. Now, I never knew much about the guy, but I would, you know, you would hear his name from time to time in the news. So the name stuck with me. I mean, he was just, I think, just another mealy-mouthed politician, just basically a non-entity. But he wrote a book, his memoirs, called As I Saw It. And what's really interesting, you know, I hardly ever read books by people like this, like, you know, Clinton or Kissinger. I'm just, you know, as far as I know, they're just self-serving baloney, and they cut out a lot of stuff. They want to make themselves look good. So, but every once in a while, you'll find a nugget in one of these autobiographies. And I want to read you, this is incredible to me, incredible revisionist history. And Rusk, I think, was more honest than most. I think I just thumbed through his book. You know, I went right to the page that had where that link had indicated he talked about Korea. I think he seemed I thumbed around here and there, and he seems like a pretty honest guy. Like, after he left government, he was pretty much he would admit his mistakes, and he seemed like a fairly honest guy. So now, back in at the end of World War II, he was a military bureaucrat, never saw combat, stationed somewhere in Asia. And for whatever reason, he was given the assignment after the atomic bombs on Japan were dropped on Japan. One of the terms was that Japan had occupied Korea since 1910, and one of the terms of their surrender was that they had to leave Korea altogether. So here we have this country of Korea. It's just like a vacuum. And he was given the assignment. He and a colleague of his, a guy named Colonel Charles Bonesteel, whose nickname was Tick, they were given the assignment of what to do with Korea. So I want to read you from page – this just blew my mind when I read it. This is from page 124. I don't have the book, but I made a photocopy of that page. I just want to take like 2 minutes and read this. Okay, he says, the State Department wanted us to accept the surrender, and he's talking about Japan, as far north on the mainland of China as possible, including key points in Manchuria. But the U.S. Army, concerned about the future, did not want responsibility for areas where it had no or few forces. In fact, the Army did not want to go into the mainland at all. We finally reached a compromise that would keep at least some U.S. forces on the Asian mainland, a sort of toehold on the Korean Peninsula for symbolic purposes. During a SWINC meeting, and SWINC is just an acronym for some military bureaucracy. I forget what it stands for. During a SWINC meeting on August 14th, 1945, the same day of the Japanese surrender, Colonel Charles Bonesteel and I retired to an adjacent room late at night and studied intently a map of the Korean Peninsula. Working in haste and under great pressure, we had a formidable task to pick a zone for the American occupation. Neither Tick nor I was a Korea expert, but it seemed to us that Seoul, the capital, should be in the American sector. We also knew that the U.S. Army opposed an extensive area of occupation. Using a National Geographic map, we looked just north of Seoul for a convenient dividing line, but could not find a natural geographical line. We saw instead the 38th parallel and decided to recommend that. Then in the next paragraph, he just goes on and on about how they were ignorant. They really didn't know much about Korea, but they were so damn tired, they just decided on the 38th parallel.
And, just like a totally arbitrary decision.
Yeah, okay, we're tired, and let's just do this. Let's get this over. You know, he's very straight about it. Let me just read a little bit of the next paragraph. No one present at our meeting, including two young American colonels, talking about him and his colleague, was aware at the turn of the century the Russians and Japanese had discussed spheres of influence in Korea divided along the 38th parallel. Had we known that, we almost certainly would have chosen another line of demarcation. Remembering those earlier discussions, the Russians might have interpreted our action as acknowledgement of their sphere of influence in Korea north of the 38th parallel. Any future talk about the agreed-upon reunification of Korea would be seen as mere show. But we were ignorant of all this, and Swink's choice of the 38th parallel, recommended by two tired colonels working late at night, proved fateful. Now, this, to me, that, when I read that, that just blew my mind. And just to give you, to draw an analogy, Korea, the whole country of Korea, it's a small country. It's almost the same exact size geographically as Minnesota. So basically what they did, and now imagine Canada, just picture Canada being like a hardcore communist country to our north, and you know, we being a relatively free country, a republic to the south. Imagine somebody just going into Minnesota and saying, okay, folks, all you people that live north of Interstate 94, we're going to hand you over to Canada. And all everybody south of Interstate 94, you're going to be a Western so-called democracy. That's basically exactly what happened, just to draw an analogy.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
So that's how Korea was divided into north and south. There had never been any north and south before that. And basically, we handed the north over to Stalin. His Stalin's point man in North Korea was Kim Il-sung, who was Kim Jong-un's grandfather. So, and it took them like maybe 3 years, 3 years of chaos. You know, the people of North Korea had absolutely no say in the matter. They were just basically had this communist, really hardcore communist dictatorship clamped down on them. And it took Kim Il-sung about 3 years, with the usual totalitarian methods of just getting control of people's minds, and that's how Korea was split in half.
Right,
it's completely artificial,
and that's what ultimately led to the Korean War. Right, I mean the Korean War started what in like the 1950s.
1950, June.
June right
of
in
1950.
Yeah, one of the major instigators of that conflict was this huge American military presence in South Korea, right?
Well, you know, you can interpret that any way you want. You know, so some people say that certainly there was truth to that, but also people say, you know, Kim Il-sung wanted to just invade, just take over the whole country, and turn it, you know, into his own, you know, make the whole country a communist, a Stalinist dictatorship. Closely allied with Russia, and things were happening in China at the time too. This is right around the time that China went totally communist.
In reading your article, I know the Korean War is often referred to as the Forgotten War, and it's a war that like I don't really know a whole lot about. The more that I think about it, after reading some of your articles on this topic. But it was absolutely devastating for the country itself, for especially North Korea. And wasn't it something like 36,000 American soldiers died? I think you cite that in one.
Something like that. But,
yeah,
you know,
I mean, that's a huge number of American soldiers dying in a war that people don't even know the first thing about.
You know, it's interesting you say that. That the war went on for 3 years. It ended in 1953. I, in my entire education, and I majored in history in college, I never heard one word about the Korean War. Nothing. And it was just like a complete blank. And what we did to that country is just basically we just, you know, people talk about people, some American yahoos like to shoot their mouths off about turning a country into a parking lot. Well, that's what we did to North Korea. Basically, we used that country as a testing ground for napalm, which was used. It had been invented near the end of the Second World War. It was used in a limited capacity in Japan, but weed, they went all out with napalm in the Korean War. And the analogy I like to make is, imagine we killed, through bombing, through napalm, conventional bombing, starvation, disease, everything that happens in war, we wiped out about 25% of the civilian population of North Korea.
25%? My 25%, goodness. Yeah, that's...
The analogy I like to make is this. Imagine filling all of our 30 Major League Baseball stadiums with innocent men, women, and children, drenching them with gasoline, and just throwing a lit match on them. Because that's what napalm is, jelly gasoline. So that's what we did to that country. And how many people know that? And how many people... And this has so much to do with the attitude of the North Korean government towards our government and the military. We holocausted, like I said, 25% of the population. And it's really crazy. I started researching this, again, just shortly before I went on my trip. And I came across a declassified memorandum dated April 20th, 1951. And it referred to, you remember Vice President Al Gore, his father at that time had, this is so insane, he had recommended just sprinkling the 38th parallel with atomic bombs to create a radioactive dead zone, just to stop the North from invading the South. I mean, just complete insanity, they ran these genocidal ideas through Congress and stuff. And the memorandum actually said that it said something to the effect, this is on my website, I have it on the Orinoco, that page. It said something to the effect that this is impractical, but it should be kept in mind for a possible future consideration or something like that. So this is the kind of mentality that was that existed in American government circles at the time.
Well, that's the same exact policy they pursued against Germany during World War II and Japan,
yes.
And Japan for that matter.
Yes,
and
yes.
Even during the Civil War, there were some very barbaric things that the Union Army did, for example, in the South.
Yeah.
So this concept of like total war where you're like destroying entire cities and infrastructure and targeting civilian centers. I mean, this is something that our military has a long history of engaging in, and it's something that, I don't know how any genuine American patriot could support something like this. This is outrageous.
I know. It's just, if people knew the truth. And I think, you mentioned Germany and Japan. And, yes, people have no idea how extensively we just carpet bombed those countries, just burning hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people alive. But I think North Korea was the ultimate. I think... I read somewhere that by the end of 1950, this sounds crazy, by the end of 1952, there was nothing left to bomb. I mean, we just completely flattened that country. And, you have to getting back to the Pueblo incident, I read the captain of that ship was a guy named Lloyd Bucher, and he came across, and it's a very interesting book, and he comes across as a really good guy, a really decent self-made man, but nowhere in that book, it goes through the whole thing about the day that things started to develop out there off the coast of North Korea. And he's so self-righteous about the fact, and he all but admits that they were spying on the country. But he insisted, and I think he's right. I believe him, they were in international waters, just a few miles outside. They were 15 miles off the coast of North Korea. But he simply does not grasp the fact. As far as I recall in reading that book, there is nothing about what we did to that country during the Korean War. In other words, he just can't see, for example, that these North Korean sailors that captured him and his guys were brutally beaten several times when they were in captivity. He just cannot grasp the fact that, like, their parents and their grandparents, most of their parents and or grandparents were probably killed or lost everything they had in the Korean War due to American terror bombing. I mean, he just doesn't get it, and he just doesn't. He doesn't see that there are no rules. Like, here we are, halfway across the world, and we send a whole fleet of B-29s or B-52s, I forget which planes, just to flatten that country. And he's outraged that he thinks there's certain rules that we have that they have to adhere to, that they can't attack an American ship just off that coast, even though they were out just outside of their territorial waters. So this is the whole problem.
This is the double standards, the hypocrisy, just the total disconnect from reality.
Well, this is how America. This is how I was brought up. We were the good guys. We could do no wrong. So
right.
Whenever we, you know, especially, you know, I grew, you know, the Vietnam War actually was my, you know, I don't want to get off into another tangent here, but you know, I thought at the time, you know, we were bombing the hell out of Hanoi and the North. You know, it doesn't matter. We're the good guys. If we're doing it, we're doing it for a higher moral reason. You know, that's just, you know, so many Americans are conditioned that way. And well, this is the thing about travel. You get to see your own country from the outside, and it's very often not a pretty picture. So
well, yeah, and you know that's definitely an aspect that I want to ask you about. I mean, what do average like North Koreans think about America or like Americans in general? Did you get to talk to anybody? Like, what just their basic impressions?
That's something I want to get into. I would like to go. You know, I hope we're not running out of time because I really love talking about this. But anyway, let me just run up to the time. I'll get to your question in a minute. You know, everybody, like I said, as I said earlier, just about 99% of trips to North Korea begin and end in Beijing. And I would have loved to take the train in. For some reason, they had some rule. Americans could not. We were like the only nationality that couldn't get it was like a 24-hour train from Beijing to Pyongyang. And they came up with some rule. We had to fly in, just Americans. So we had no choice. I had to fly there. So we flew into Pyongyang. Anyway, the day before departure, we had Young Pioneer Tours. They had notified everybody on the tour. We would have a meeting at a hotel in Beijing, and we're going to answer all the questions and just give you a rundown of the do's and don'ts in North Korea. So it was kind of neat, you know. We were all in this. Oh, my cat just knocked over my.
No problem.
All right, come here, Coach. What are you doing? Yeah, okay. So we're in a hotel. It was kind of neat, you know. There was about 50 people, 50, 55 people, and we were going to be split into three separate groups. And we're all sitting in at the bar there. Well, you know, a big room, a bunch of tables. Everybody settled down with a beer. And, you know, everybody, we're all a little bit nervous, okay? You know, just a little apprehensive about going to this mysterious country. So a lot of people had questions. Basically, what we were told is that it is a very safe country. It's just a couple of rules you have to keep in mind. And the three main ones were this: no criticism or displays of disrespect towards the regime, no distribution of religious literature, and you can't wander off on your own. You have to stick with the group. You can't just walk up to people. As I later found out, if you tried doing that, they would just run away, because it really is, it's a very stiff communist, you know, dictatorship. No wandering off on your own. You have to kind of stay with the group. And they mentioned about photographs. Or if you see anybody in uniform, just ask permission first. But I found out later they were very lenient about photographs. We were pretty much – they were just like one or two road checkpoints. We were told to just keep our cameras low and not photograph anything. So anyway, all right, so the next day we're at Beijing at the airport. And it's such a surreal experience. You're in Beijing. Huge airport, but, you know, very busy. You know, just like New York or Chicago or Paris or London. Huge airport, flights taking off and landing every few minutes. And it's a 90-minute flight from Beijing to Pyongyang. So you leave Beijing, and it was on Air China. And you're approaching Pyongyang airport. It's almost like you're landing on Mars, you know, the most isolated, sealed off country in the world. So we land, and it's very strange. There's just like nothing going on. I remember there were three or four airplanes, just small airplanes parked at odd angles. And You know, it's like, oh, here I am. Unbelievable. I'm in North Korea.
Wow.
So we walk into, this is a funny story. We walk into the terminal. And as I said, we were told, you know, whenever there are people in uniform, ask permission for taking photographs. So what is this? There's an American woman in our group. Actually, she was a nice lady. She was from the Midwest. So what does she do? First thing, we're in the terminal building. And I have to tell you this, in the terminal, there were exactly two flights landing, two arrivals and two departures that day. And they were handwritten on a big board. I mean, it was like a small Greyhound bus terminal. Although, from what I've heard, I think they've rebuilt it. They've made a bigger terminal now. But it was like a little dinky Greyhound bus terminal in the middle of nowhere, here in the capital city, you know. So as soon as we walk into the terminal, this woman, what does she do? She takes out her camera, and she takes a picture. And there are five North Korean soldiers standing against the wall. And I'm like, oh, my God.
She, like, immediately violates the rules?
Yeah, immediately, as soon as we're in the terminal building. So one of the soldiers walks up, and I said, oh, my God, here he comes. You know, she's going to be arrested, handcuffed. I don't know. You know, you don't know what to expect. So this guy tapped her on the shoulder. And, you know, she turned around, and he didn't speak any English. He just put up his palm out, like, stop. You know, and that was the end of it. She put her camera away. Nothing happened. So, then we took,
how typical, just clueless, brain dead American, just as soon as you get there,
really?
Immediately violate the rules. Yeah.
I know. And again, she was a good person. She just had a few quirks.
And she, and
just,
no doubt,
can't
she,
follow
she,
rules.
Yeah,
they,
she probably didn't,
follow.
She didn't mean anything by it. She's just,
no.
You know, it's just,
anyway,
so typical
just
American.
Passed.
Yeah.
It just passed. It was nothing, but, you know, but that just gives you an idea. I mean, it's not as, you know, the officials were not ready to arrest anybody. You know, it's not what they knew it was, it's not what we were there for. You know, we want to see the country and, anyway, so we take a bus to the right into the city of Pyongyang, and we stayed at the Yanggakdo Hotel, and we went in there, and that was one of the really, it kind of had a festive atmosphere, if you can imagine that. It's like, oh my God, I'm really here. We are, we're checking into a hotel. It was pretty busy actually. There were a lot of Chinese businessmen checking in, checking out, other tourist groups checking in, checking out, and. You know, we got into our rooms, and then we just, you know, the tour leader. And I got to say, this is another thing that's crazy. People think it's such a dangerous place. Our tour leader was American. He was an American guy. His name was Chris White. And there was another American guy at the time named Joe Ferris. I have a couple of pictures of him, actually. These were like down-to-earth guys. Chris was a underwater demolitions specialist. I think he just worked in different parts of the world. And Joe worked on an oceanographic vessel. Supposedly these people hate Americans so much. And here they are leading tours in North Korea. So, you know, we got settled in and we met our two tour guides, English speaking tour guides. The woman's name was Choi and the guy's name was Han.
And they were both North Koreans?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, okay.
They were fluent in English. And we just had a few beers with them, and I felt very, very relaxed. I said, you know what, nothing bad is going to happen in this country. I just want to go over some of the things. I was there for, it was a week-long tour. And again, going back to what Orwell said, I mean, you find out people, and I don't know how many Korean people you know in the States. You know, I know on Long Island, for some reason they're very big in the dry cleaning business on Long Island, and you know, being an oil truck driver, they go through a lot of heating oil. So I became acquainted with. I would make frequent deliveries, and I would talk to them. And they would, you know, the Korean people in general are, you know, are a law-abiding, polite people. You know, they're not an offensive people, and basically it's the same race. They're the same people over there. Same kind of Korean people that I had seen in South Korea. You know, just basically nice people, okay? It's very, I never felt, you don't feel in fear of any kind of violent crime or anything like that. So, I just want to give you some impressions. And again, John, you can jump in with any questions.
I just want one question right off the bat. How big of a city is Pyongyang? Is it like a major urban center, or is it kind of spread out, or like what was your impression, just like the population and density wise?
I mean, it's not huge. Again, you can't walk around on your own. Okay, that's one of the rules. You got to stick with the group. I don't know. I would compare it to something like, area wise. I really don't. I could punch up right now, see what the population is. It's absolutely nothing like Beijing. Or Beijing is just monstrous. It just sprawls on forever. Pyongyang is not like that. And again, the
Wikipedia says 3.2 million.
Really, that many? That surprised
me.
That surprises
me too. Yeah.
I would have guessed like a half a million, but maybe they're just talking about the suburbs that just go out and out. I don't know. But it didn't really impress me as a. It impressed me as a place that. If we were free to walk around on our own, you could pretty much cover what you wanted to see in 2 or 3 days just by walking. It was very run down. There was a lot of potholes in the streets. The apartment buildings, everybody there lives in apartments. There were just a lot of peeling paint, very kind of an unkempt place. Very, very few vehicles on the road. And that's the situation for the whole country. There's very few. I don't believe there are any privately owned vehicles. Everything is government, and there are very, very few of them. So even in the capital city, there was very little traffic. There was some traffic, but not a whole lot. And you would see buses going by from time to time. They look like something out of the 1960s. People just crammed in, totally crammed in. And so it was kind of, it was kind of a rundown place, but still, up and running. I mean, it's the big city. And as I learned from my reading, it's really, if you are a North Korean, it's really the most desirable place to live. We're getting into the communist system. Again, I don't know how true this is, but from what I understand, the people that are most reliable, that are like the most devoted to the regime, are the ones that are allowed to live in Pyongyang. Whereas... people that are less reliable, they're like moved out to the countryside. It's very strange. I don't know if this is true, but from what I've read, they want to take the people that are more rebellious or more intelligent or more non-compliant, and they move their entire families out into the countryside, into the worst parts of the country and into the labor camps and stuff because they want to breed them out. It sounds crazy. I don't know how true it is. It might be true, but I have to tell you, it's a and this is the reason they don't want any religious literature in the country. It is really a very strange divine personality cult of Kim Jong-un's grandfather, Kim Il-sung, and his father, Kim Jong-il. And by the way, it's the only hereditary communist regime. Kim Il-sung was the first, and then his son, then his grandson.
Mm-hmm.
So
they're like put on a pedestal as like the savior of the country and like
exactly. It's a divine personality cult. You see their faces everywhere, and people have to wear badges, small, the way people wear American flags on their lapels. Well, over there you see people. I think I'm not sure if they have to, but it would be a pretty good idea to if you're a North Korean. They wear a little pin with the little picture of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. And, you walk around, again, with the group, the people you see. I've never seen, in all the countries I've been to, I've never seen faces like I've seen in that country. Just the older people I'm talking about, the middle-aged and older people, just their faces are just worn out. I mean, it's like they've been in prison. They're just beaten down. Not so much with the younger people. But the older people, you could see that they've had a hard life. And when I was there, I said to myself, everybody I see in this country, either, it goes back to the Korean War, really. Either they lost their parents or grandparents. Either they were killed in the war or they lost everything they had. And now they have this very repressive communist dictatorship, and that's what they've been living with their whole lives. So, but I have to say this also. I mean, it was a very, especially compared to South Korea, it's a very pure country. Very most of the people you see are kind of wear drab clothes. But a lot of women wear like the Korean folk dresses, which are very beautiful. So they're very proud of their, you know, their heritage, their country, their culture. And in the few gift shops we went to, there was some really beautiful art. In fact, I bought a little vase. They're very into their culture. One thing I wanted to mention, I want to mention some of the things that we did when we were in the country. One of the things that was really incredible. Have you ever heard of the Arirang Mass Games by any chance?
I do not believe so.
Okay. Arirang. That's one of the things we did when we were in Pyongyang. And the only way I could describe it, it was the way I – this is going to sound a little funny. It was like a cross between the Nuremberg rallies in National Socialist Germany and the Super Bowl halftime show. I mean, that sounds a little crazy. Without the degeneracy. Totally pure Korean culture. And we went to that one night in Pyongyang, and it was just – it was such an emotional experience. It was just – it was like a tribal – well, I say tribal. I'm not implying anything primitive. It was just so purely Korean. Just these big spectacles. You could go on YouTube. There are, I have it actually – I have like a two-minute clip of the, of the video I took when I was there. But you can – you can go on YouTube and just punch in Arirang Mass Games, and there are much longer videos of it. It's just an incredible spectacle, and I don't think you could ever see anything like that in South Korea, because South Korea, just from the 5 days I was there, is very Americanized. Seoul was very, very it was a very modern, cosmopolitan city. Nothing at all like the North. So there's really a big difference that way. So they have held on to their pure Korean culture, and it's really something you can appreciate. But let me just say, you know, we were talking about Pyongyang. We did a few things when we did several things when we were there. We went as a group. We took the subway, which is kind of fascinating. I believe it's the deepest subway in the world. It's really, you take an escalator way, way, way down deep. And we just did that. We just see what the, you know, everyday life was like there. We went to an amusement park at night, something you usually don't associate with North Korea. But, you know, it was good just to see people enjoying themselves. It was like any American amusement park. We went to a pizzeria. One of the best. We went. They took us into a hospital, and it was they brought a doctor out, and of course we had the two tour guides, translating, and he was just very, very kind. The people that interact with foreign tourists are the happiest people there, because it's like, since the country is so sealed off, they're just so happy to make contact with foreigners, you know, it's like the little contact with the outside world that they're allowed. So the people in the restaurants and the hotels, very, very, very polite, very sweet. And we were allowed sometimes on a limited basis to interact with the locals, but always with the tour guides there, with them translating. And one day we were out in the countryside, and it was a little town called Nampo, a seaside town. And we ran into a volleyball match, so they all invited us to play volleyball. I have a clip of that, actually, on Orinoco. And so all these little things. Well, as I was saying before, we went to a hospital, and it looked like something from the 1950s. And I couldn't believe we went to a cancer, the cancer ward on the hospital. And I really couldn't believe this. They let us get really up close to people who were being treated. Some of them were partially undressed, and I felt like I was violating their space. I said, you know, we shouldn't be seeing this. We're looking at these people with cancer, and it was just, It was just a very strange experience, but
yeah, it's kind of strange.
It is. It's very weird, you know. But then we went to a high school. I think I was telling you about this a few days ago. We went to a high school. Did you see those? Some of the video clips I took in the high school we went to.
I have not seen the high school clips. Is that in which article is that on?
That is in Orinoco. I have a lot of photos and videos of my trip. We were taken to a high school, and we went to I have one video clip of girls playing an instrument called the gangyeom. It's a Korean instrument. And they brought us into, you know, this was like extracurricular activities. It was like after school had been left out, let out. And we went to that. We went to another room where they're having accordion practice. And then we went to, there was a performance on the high school stage just for all the foreign tourists. There was five or six girls singing. Very, 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 very sweet. Everybody was just so nice, you know. And it was, and then, you know, it was interesting. You know, I was saying the people that have contact with the tourists are the happiest people. And when we would drive from place to place on the bus, it was a very old bus and went very slow, probably saving fuel, I guess, which isn't, they don't have too much of over there. And I remember Hans sitting down, who was the mail guide. He just took a seat next to me. He was just very curious. He asked me if I had any children. I said, yeah. He goes, and I showed him pictures. He just had so many questions. What's New York like? You know, I told you, what is your job? What is it like? They were just so sweet and curious about the outside world. And Choi, who was the woman guide, she was the same way. And, you know, they're very human. They have different personalities. Han was like a quiet, reflective kind of guy. And Choi was like she kind of had an impish sense of humor. Again, you know, you're dealing with real people. They're not robots. They don't hate Americans or anything like that. Although, if you go on my website, I don't know if you saw the two postcards I had. there are some, you know, they're extremely hostile against the U.S. military and government.
Well, I mean, frankly, understandably so, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, geez, especially considering everything they've been through. You know, I got to ask you real quick. Have you seen that you can find it on YouTube. In fact, I'll post a link to it when I post this podcast program, maybe in the comment section. I remember seeing it years ago when it first came out. I think this was like in 2012. In fact, the video that I'm looking at on YouTube was published on November 9th of 2012. It's called North Korea Exposes Western Propaganda. It's like a documentary. Have you seen that? Are you familiar with it? It's very, very interesting. It actually does a really, really good job of sort of explaining how the mass media in the West, especially in America, is just something we've talked about previously, a total psychological weapon used to control, manipulate, traumatize, and like program the masses. It's very much worth watching. It's like an hour and a half long. I haven't seen the documentary for a long time. I remember watching it when it first came out, or when I first discovered it, I should say, back in like 2012. But it is fascinating. Right at the very beginning of the documentary, they talk about the concept of public relations and how it's an industry designed to alter perception, reshape reality, and manufacture consent. And basically it goes on and it says that the public relations industry totally dominates the U.S., where its practitioners are accurately described as professional liars. Now, and so they seem to have a very keen insight into the way propaganda works in the West.
Was this put up by somebody in North Korea?
Yeah, from what I understand, it was like officially produced by the North Korean government. You can watch it with like the full translation, like in English, and it's pretty good. I mean, again, I'm not 100% sure about that. I mean, I remember seeing it when it first came out, and I was just searching earlier today when I was reading some of your articles. I was like, I wonder if that documentary is still on YouTube, and sure enough, I found it.
You know, obviously they brainwash their own people, but I think in this country and in the West generally, it's much more sophisticated.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, because we're made to believe that we are free and we do live in a free country and it's this, you know, righteous country. I mean, it's basically the same thing, just, you know, an American version, you know, and it's totally controlled by Jews here. Whereas North Korea, it's, I can imagine it's quite a bit different. Yeah.
You know, before, I don't know how much time we have left. I just want to touch on a few other things before we run out of time here. I mean, I just love talking about this.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, okay. In Pyongyang also, we went to, are you familiar? It's a very famous site of Kim Jong-un's father and grandfather. There's two huge bronze statues of them. It's a very famous picture. I don't know if you've seen it.
Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about. What do you know the name of it? The site?
I don't know if there's a name. It's in a square. The name of the square, I can't think of it right now. But anyway, that was part of, just to give you an idea how what an experience it is going there. We were in the bus. We got out, and they said, look, you know, we're going to go up as a group, and we're going to go right up to the statues, and you have to bow in reverence. They said, if you have a problem, and this is Chris talking, the American guy, if you have a problem with it, just stay on the bus. It's not a problem. But if you go up there, you have to bow, or else you're going to be arrested for disrespecting the regime.
Wow. So, yeah, that's insane,
It's very simple. You know, if you want to do it, don't be a jerk.
Right,
If you want to stand there and fold your arms in defiance, you're going to be arrested. So, of course, everybody, you know, I did it with everybody else. We all bowed. And the only really heavy, I would say, intense moment was we went to the Kum Sasong Mausoleum, where Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung lie in state. And we were told very, very, very carefully, just when you walk in there, just do as you do not change the expression on your face. Do not talk. Do not do anything. Just do as you're told. So we went into the it's a big palace, and their bodies are lying in state. They're in big glass cubicles, and they're in separate rooms. This is Kim Jong-un's father and grandfather. And you go up in groups of four. You know, the bodies are right there. It's, you know, like Lenin and Mao and all that stuff. And you bow on the left side. You walk around to the bottom. You bow at their feet. And then you walk around to the right side, and you bow at the right side. And then, there are North Korean soldiers there with big rifles.
Wow. Incredible.
It was a real experience. And you go from one room into the next, you know, where they're lying in state. And absolutely no photos over there. Although you could find them on the internet. I guess the North Korean government has put them out. So, that was a real experience. And the other thing, you know, and just quickly just to give you an idea, the other things we did, we went to a movie studio in the country. We went to a water bottling plant. Just to get an idea, you know, it's pretty much, you know, take the communism away, and it's just a country that's pretty much self-sufficient, okay? They have to do what they have to do. Now, one of the last thing I want to mention about what we did in the country, this was really fascinating. We went to the DMZ from the north side, and I still remember driving towards the border, and they had huge concrete columns. As you got closer to the border, there were huge concrete columns. And Chris told us that those were put up in cases of an invasion from the south. They would just pull these columns down just to block any tanks coming across. It was just a very strange sight. And then the funny thing was, we got to the DMZ on the north side, and it was much more relaxed than what I had experienced on the south side. They had a museum there for the Korean War, and that's where. And on the Orinoco side, you can see I took there's a picture of me on the homepage next to a North Korean soldier. We all took pictures with North Korean soldiers, and we just kind of milled around. I mean, it was a much more relaxed. That's the strangest thing in the world. You would think it would be more tense from the north side, but no, it was very easygoing. But it was just very interesting seeing the DMZ, from both sides. And I don't know how many people in the world have seen it. Not that I'm tooting my own horn here, but it was just having seen it from both the DMZ, the most heavily fortified border in the world, from both sides, was just really a fascinating experience. But then, you know, just to, again, I think we're probably running out of time. You know, I was so, you know, something in me said, why can't we be friends with these people? I mean, you know, it's so safe as long as you follow a few simple rules. You know, I got back home and I tried to start. That's where I started the, put my website up, orinocotravel.com. I said, I want to be the first American to take people there, to actually take them, originating in the States from any major city. I wanted to fly them there. I spoke to the people at Young Pioneer Tours. They were very good about it, very open about it. And, you know, I put a lot of, well, that's the whole story I wrote on End the Shots page about what I went through. Three or four years doing everything I could to try to, you know, get people interested in North Korea. And I just couldn't make any headway. People just so brainwashed about how to hate us, this and that. And then the whole thing with Otto Warmbier, the American college kid that was arrested there for that's the thing that
disrespecting the regime or something. What was it?
Know. Well, you know, let me just say, I don't know how many people, how many Americans. Again, we were free to go there from 2010 to 2017. You can't go there now because of a law, because Trump, you know, all this crap that was signed into law in 2017. It was 7 years where you could go there. My educated guess is that roughly 5,000 Americans. Ordinary Americans went there on an ordinary tourist visa in those 7 years. And then what happened was, and of those estimated 5,000, only five Americans were arrested for disrespecting the regime. And four out of five did something blatantly illegal. One guy left a Bible in a men's room at a restaurant somewhere. Another guy who was a complete jerk, he got there and he ripped up his visa. He said something like, this guy was like a psycho. He wanted to go to, he ripped up his visa, or his passport, whatever, as soon as he got there. He wanted to go to a North Korean jail to see what it was like. Just a nutcase. There was only one guy, it was like a borderline case. He was an American, he was a veteran of the Korean War. He was like 85 years old. And he started saying things that his tour guides did not like about the Korean War, about the North Korean soldiers or something like that. And one thing led to another. And then he was not in prison, but they held him in his hotel room and they made him confess to being disrespectful towards the regime or something like that. And after a few weeks, they let him go. But the thing with Otto Warmbier was, he's a 21-year-old kid. He went there with the same outfit I went, the Young Pioneer Tours, stayed at the same hotel, the Yangakdo Hotel. That's where he got into trouble. Now, there's an interesting story there. He knew, you know, when you're in that hotel, that's the one place you were, like, allowed to do what you wanted to do. There were a couple of bars. There was a restaurant. There was a gift shop. You could just wander around. You couldn't leave the hotel, but you could just wander around the hotel on your own. And he went to the fifth floor, and there is no elevator stop at the fifth floor. And somehow he knew, I read about this much later, that some people had snuck onto the fifth floor, which is off limits to tourists. You could only get there by the stairwell. And other people had known about this and had gone there and photographed it, because it's just the corridors on the fifth floor were lined with all kinds of propaganda posters and stuff. So he went there, and when I was there, this was like, he was there like 3 years after I was, and I didn't know anything about it. I'm not interested in it. I'm just going to obey the rules. You wouldn't go to a staff-only floor in any country. It's something you don't do. And anyway, he went on the fifth floor. He must have known about it somehow, and he tried to pull down a poster of Kim Jong-un's father and grandfather, and he was caught on camera, and then when he was ready to leave the country, this was like, they were there for like a New Year's party, like 3 days from December 31st to January 2nd, I think 2016 to 2017, maybe it was 2015 to 2016. And he was caught on camera, and at the airport, they pulled him out of the line, and then he was given a trial and sentenced to 15 years in prison for disrespect to the regime or whatever it was. And I think, And as you know, people that remember that incident, he was kind of forgotten about. And then a year and a half later, I think it was June of 2017, they announced that he was in a coma, and he was flown back to the States. He was from Cincinnati, and then he died a few days later. And that was a huge, huge story. And that's what led to to Americans not being able to go there. But, I think what probably happened is he caught some kind of, I think they were going to let him go because they're really big on, if you feel remorse for something you've done wrong, if you express contrition, which he did at his trial, he broke down in tears. I think they were going to let him go. And this is my guess now. They locked him up and then they were horrified that he fell ill. He came down with botulism, which is what they claimed. But anyway, that was the end of that. And that was the end of, it wasn't the total end of my efforts to try to bring people there, but that put a big damper on it. And I have the whole story. I try to make it as amusing as I can on the End of Shots page, North Korea case study. Everything I went through, all the mailings, the emails, years and years. I did a radio show in Boston. I did a few interviews. I had a few write-ups in some newspapers. But all the effort I put into it, I couldn't make any headway against all the fear that has been put into people's heads about, you know, North Korea. They hate us. It's very dangerous to go there. There was a Department of State travel advisory really warning against people going there. You read that. It's just such propaganda. I have it. Again, I have it on it's part of the story. I have it in the Shots page. You read that and you say to yourself, nobody in their right mind would ever go to this country. And it's just such crap. Again, as I said, you just follow the rules. I felt totally, totally safe there. And I really, it was my dream. I mean, it sounds a little crazy. I said, let me do what I could do just to maybe I can be a part of history and, make the American government see this country in a completely different light. Make the American people see it in a different light. Let me see this. I want to see this country reunified the way Vietnam was, the way Germany was, because it's such an artificial separation between North and South. Again, it's like cutting Minnesota in half and saying, and you have a completely different North Minnesota and South Minnesota. I mean, it just makes no sense at all. So.
Very, very interesting. Man, there's so much more that we could talk about. And you know what? We got to, maybe come up with a plan and do this, as a regular series and kind of talk about all your travel experiences.
I'd love to talk about Iran, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's still some stuff that I could ask you about just your experience in North Korea. But I think we'll wait. I think that was a good intro, just to obviously to your experience in North Korea. But there's much, much more that we could talk about. And you can find a lot of this information at endtheshots.com, and then you have that section travel stories that's got probably maybe a dozen or maybe even more articles just about all your different experiences all over the world. I've read a few of them. I read the one about Africa, as I mentioned before we started. I read three or four articles on the OrinocoTravel.com website as well. And a lot of that material seems to be pretty related to your story about North Korea on End the Shots. So, yeah, there's...
Yeah, Orinoco is just purely North Korea. I put that site up just for the express purpose of taking people to North Korea. There's a lot of photographs and videos on that site. But the one I wrote on End the Shots was more recent. It was about my saga of trying to bring people to North Korea for the first time. And I think, again, I tried to make it as entertaining as possible. But it's a really good story about how everything I went through, all the people I contacted,
absolutely.
In the government, in the media, in schools, and I just couldn't get anywhere. I actually met – I'm glad this just popped into my head. I wrote to the North Korean embassy to the United Nations. And the North Korean ambassador contacted me, and I met him and his associate in the Olympia Diner, just a few blocks from the United Nations. So here I am. I'm talking to the the North Korean ambassador, and we were trying to come up with a plan to get out of. This was before we knew he was in a coma and everything. I was trying to come up with a plan. I talked to them about a plan about bringing a sports team to North Korea in exchange for his release. And that was an interesting conversation. We ended up talking. I was only there with them for about 15 minutes. And what did we end up talking about? We ended up talking about fishing. I'm an avid fisherman.
Yeah.
I'm an avid fisherman. And when you go to Korea, it's south and north, I mean, that's the two leisurely activities that you see people enjoy in North Korea is fishing and public dancing. They're really with their beautiful with the woman with their beautiful dresses. They set up speakers, and you see people just dancing in public. It's a very pleasant thing to see. So yeah, we ended up
very
talking
cool.
about fishing most of the time. So read both sites. I mean, they're both. If you want to learn about North Korea, you know, anybody listening to this, it just you know, the Orinoco site is basically it's just up there. I mean, it's really just kind of a there's nothing going on with it. I can't take people there anymore, but it's still up and running. And as I said, there are a lot of videos and photographs I took there, so that should take the mystery out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And and I'll have links over to both the sites where you can read just basically exclusively about your travel experiences. And yeah, man, I would definitely like to do this again. This was a great conversation. It's a fascinating subject. I mean, I don't know how many total Americans have ever been to North Korea, but it's probably not, you know, less than 1,000, I would guess, anyways, at least, you know, private citizens.
I would say about 5,000. And again, we can't go there now for the last 5 years. John, do we have a couple of minutes? Can I make it? We have like 5 minutes left there.
Yeah, yeah, go ahead. I do have to wrap up very quickly,
okay.
But go ahead if you want to.
I want to mention one guy. Are you familiar with Paul McCloskey, who used to be a congressman from California?
Yes.
Okay. Well, he's out of the picture now. He's like, he must be about 95 years old now. Let me, you know, I did a lot of research, and it's nothing but garbage you read about North Korea. I found, in all of my research, I found two very worthwhile newspaper articles. Now, Paul McCloskey, he was one of the very few politicians in Washington that had any honor and integrity. And he kind of, you know, he was a very principled man. And he had been a Marine platoon leader in the Korean War. And he was wounded twice. And he, at the age of 86, I think like 8 or 9 years ago, he returned to North Korea. And by chance, he ran into a North Korean general who had also been wounded in the Korean War at a museum over there. And there was a female soldier who spoke English, and she was interpreting between the two. They were recounting the battles they were in, and they ended up hugging each other very emotionally and vowing that their grandchildren and their great grandchildren would never go to war against each other. It's a very moving article. And if you want to find it, I'm looking at it right now. I printed it from the South San Francisco. McCloskey's from California. The San Francisco Gate. The title is War Hero Pete McCloskey Back from Reunion in North Korea, and it's February 15th, 2014. And I thought it was very touching. It just added a very human touch. You know, people, and here's a general supposedly, you know, super hates everything about America. And these guys are hugging, and you know, they had both been through the hell of war, and they never wanted to see their grandchildren fighting against each other like these two had. So I would say, you know, if you get a chance, let me just read this one quote, very, very touching quote from McCloskey. He said, let me just flip down here. he said, when he came back to the States, he said, "I feel I've had an experience I've wanted to have for 64 years, which is to shake hands with one of the young kids I fought against and tell them how bravely they fought." Now, to me, that is just nobility of the heart, you know. That to me, this McCloskey is a true American hero, even though I don't agree with all his positions and stuff. But I just wish there were more people like that in the government, in the military. And that's basically how I'd like to end up our little interview here, just with that thought, that these people they really desire friendship with us. You know, everything you've seen about them hating us and launching missiles, and they're going to blow up Manhattan, or they can send missiles to Alaska or to the West Coast. It's just such crap. All right. So.
Yeah. It is ridiculous.
Yep.
Well, and meanwhile, our military is, you know, occupying, I don't know how many countries all over the world. We're involved in countless wars, have been for decades. It's,
you know,
it's like
I think
total
the military,
opposite.
The military is just falling apart. I don't even, you know, it's so woke. And, you know, I don't even know what's going on. You know, I really seem to think we're going off on a different tangent here, but, you know, all these guys that were ordered to get these shots. I mean, what's up with that? I mean, what are they trying to do? Just decimate our own ranks? I don't know. I can't see. There's no way we could ever win a ground war against any of these foreign countries. And what would we be accomplishing by even trying to do that? You know. So I don't know. The whole military situation is just a real mystery to me. I think it's finished. I don't know what else to say. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, about.
Well, I mean, we've seen like the systematic subversion of the military. I mean, now it's like tranny stuff and gay stuff.
Oh yeah.
And you know they want everybody to get the vaccine. It's just a reflection of the broader subversion and total destruction of America in general. It's disgraceful. I mean, frankly, it's embarrassing. I mean, you know, our military is like promoting trannies now, and it's just unbelievable.
Yeah,
it's a total disgrace. Yeah, it's a total disgrace.
I don't know.
Well, and I remember watching that interview with. Do you remember a lady named Kay Griggs?
Who's close? Yeah, I do.
Yeah, remember like her interviews and like the information that she was coming out with, and some of it sounded a little bit far fetched, but I wouldn't doubt a lot of what she had to say was true. So I mean, there's some very, very evil people involved in the military
very,
and at the highest levels.
Evil.
I mean, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. The higher ups. You know, there's a website. I don't know. Do you know this website, militarycorruption.com?
No, I never heard of it.
Oh yeah, you should go into that. It's run by the military. You know, good people in the military. Very. I think that's where I read about her, if I'm not mistaken.
I remember seeing her video interviews on YouTube years ago. In fact, I had kind of recently woken up to the whole like Jewish question, and I was on a website, imthewitness.com, which is no longer on online. But I remember discovering her information through that website, and it was just mind blowing. So I think a lot of that stuff is probably going on today. It certainly has gone on throughout history. So it's it's pretty despicable. It's just, I mean, this country is just a disgrace anymore, and that includes the military.
Yeah, it doesn't. You know, when you say this country, as far as I'm, you know, it doesn't even exist. It exists on paper, but I don't. I can't see things going on. And I said this 20 years ago, but you know, things have really accelerated to the point where, you know, especially with all these people now dead, dying from this COVID shot. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how things can go on like this. I think just eventually you're going to see counties seceding from states, states seceding from the country. I mean, that's what I think that the future holds. But again, this has happened in history before. You know, it's not the first time. You know, it was a great country.
That's right, exactly.
It was a great country. You know, just what I've seen in my own lifetime. I mean, if I had been transported back when I was like maybe 10 or 11 years old, back in the mid 60s to a tropical island and brought back here now, I wouldn't even recognize it. I would think I was on another planet. You know, and even back then in the 60s, I mean, there was a lot of bad stuff. I still remember the race riots and the protests against the Vietnam War. That was pretty violent stuff. I mean, it was pretty chaotic. But it was nothing compared to what we've seen in the last, you know, since COVID and George Floyd and all this and this whole sexual degeneracy that is just clamp. You know, we can't. Something's got to.
No, no country can survive this level of degeneracy. Yeah,
no, I
agree.
Also, I'm sure before in my lifetime I'm going to see something. I hope I see some radical changes. I don't know what's going to happen. So. Anyway,
cool.
I
well,
hope,
yeah, no, John, this is great. Yeah, this is a great conversation. Thanks
all right.
for explaining all your experiences.
Yeah,
yeah, no, it's great.
I hope I've enlightened and educated a lot of people out there about North Korea. So.
Oh, absolutely.
Don't
yeah.
Don't believe what you see on television. Okay. So.
Yes, sir. Okay, I'll tell you what. I will email this to you as soon as I get it posted, and we can work
okay.
out some details and maybe do another travel show.
I'd love
in
to.
The next couple of weeks. Yeah, me too. I think it'd be cool.
I always love talking about travel.
Okay, sounds good, John. You have a good
All
evening,
right,
and I'll talk to you later.
All right, take care.
Okay, bye.
All right, bye.